That all continues all the way through Saturday morning at 6. Right now, still a nice morning. Wind is calm, 33 degrees in Racine and Kenosha. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Thursday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. We have two interviews for you today, one recently recorded, the other from the morning show archives. Here is part one.
On one previous occasion, I've had the great pleasure of speaking with the Countess of Carnarvon. And the Countess of Carnarvon and her husband make their home in beautiful Highclere Castle, which, of course, many of you know from the television series Downton Abbey. Highclere Castle is something that's been in the Countess's husband's family for generations. And as a matter of fact, she has just written a book that talks about a previous member of the family who has a very special place in history. The book at hand is called The Earl and the Pharaoh: From the Real Downton Abbey to the Discovery of Tutankhamun. And this is the story of the discovery of the tomb of King Tut and the amazing riches that were found there. But far beyond that, it is the story of the life's adventure of Lord Carnarvon, the fifth Earl of Carnarvon, and his life's journey that ultimately took him to that dramatic moment in the early 1920s. This is a richly written book that tells many intriguing details about this man's life and the pathway to this important moment, as well as the controversy and mystery that surrounded his rather sudden death not long after the discovery of the tomb. This book, again, published by HarperCollins, is The Earl and the Pharaoh: From the Real Downton Abbey to the Discovery of Tutankhamun. And we welcome the Countess of Carnarvon to the morning show. We welcome you back.
Thank you so, so much. It's very kind of you to ask me back. It's wonderful to be in contact again, actually.
Yes. So particularly for the sake of our listeners who maybe didn't hear our previous conversation, which is from, I think, a couple of years ago now,
yes.
Explain the precise connection that you and your husband have to this beautiful, beautiful castle that, of course, is so renowned now all around the world.
No, it is. So Jodie and I live at Highclere, which I think many people think is Downton Abbey, and we think is Highclere Castle, but it's one and the same. You know, they didn't really change very much, and we had this film, the film crew and the series were filmed here for 6 years, and I think they've been watched by 300 or 400 million people. So what pleasure the series has given people, and now with two films as well. So It's been an extraordinary journey, and in some ways, writing this book about the Earl and the Pharaoh was equally well an extraordinary journey. And it goes back to from this world media event, which I think is what Downton Abbey has become, to the first ever global media event, which was the discovery of the tomb of Tutankhamun. So how lucky are we to be involved with both? And they both leave different legacies, and I think ones that fascinate people.
Absolutely. You say something very intriguing at the very end of the book's preface that I want to be sure to have you expand upon. You wrote, "This book has been a different journey, far richer and more diverse than I expected when I set out." Explain how this book, in a sense, became something vastly different from what you intended it to be or expected it to be at the outset.
Well, I think I set out to the publishers of writing, hang on, I'm going to just take the phone off the hook. There we go. I think when I set out, you set out the arc of the story to the publishers. And in some ways, Lord Carnarvon, the fifth Earl, was just a byline. He was financed the discovery of the tomb of Tutankhamun. He was just part of the team. And I wondered how much information I would find, how many diaries or letters, how thin or thick the sources would be. And, you know, you go out with some blag to publishers, hoping you can hit the deadline and produce something which everybody in the world wants to read, which is obviously what you hope to do as an author. And yet I then started finding more and more. And the child that I expected to find was not the young man I found. He was often not very well. He was an asthmatic who I think also smoked far too much. He was partly an invalid due to various car accidents. And yet he would not let the invalidity colour his life to completely. So he filled every minute of life with 60 seconds of life well run. So it was a very rich life in so many ways, yet he was not the gilded youth I thought I'd find. And then he disappeared from history. And I liked the contrast because, you know, Tutankhamun must have been a gilded youth growing up, you know, in the palaces of ancient Egypt. And then again, he slipped from history and he was completely forgotten about. He was, you know, superseded by the great Ramesses dynasty after he sadly died. And Lord Carnarvon, again, bestrode the world stage. He achieved a celebrity he never sought. And then a decade after that, slipped entirely from the world stage. So I felt I was finding two characters and bringing them back together. And goodness me, Lord Carnarvon would have been a fascinating dinner companion, friend to have. One of loyalty and many kindnesses.
Describe kind of the nature of the family archives there at Highclere Castle that you explored. I'm especially interested because I am just, in a sense, staggered by the level of detail with which you are able to write this account of his life. I mean, there are points in time when we feel like almost on a daily basis we know what this young man was doing and experiencing and saying and so on. What exactly was the legacy, the archival legacy that you were able to explore in order to paint such a richly detailed portrait of this man?
Well, thank you. Well, to start with, I was very lucky because his father kept a diary every day. So that was really, really lucky. So I could then get a real view of growing up at Highclere. And his sisters and his aunt, Lady Portsmouth, also kept a diary. No one had ever read them. So that was so exciting. You feel, I don't know, you feel on the edge of a world looking over, you know, and having so much ahead of you. It was so exciting. And then you begin to get a sense of what life was like. And I wanted always to put the reader into the Victorian everyday life and, you know, to find that he obviously, you know, would fire some arrows at some of the paintings or throw his get his cricket ball, break the windows, or they, you know, I just loved the detail I found. And you're trying to then choose, curate, sculpt a book, I think, in order to try to let the character go forward and the character speak. But equally well, he really was not a schoolboy who enjoyed school lessons. And I found, and I didn't realize, he'd been asked to leave his schools and most of his education establishments. And I think he would have agreed with Churchill that his education was only interrupted by his schooling. And some of the letters from his father at that point, you could see, you know, all the fathers in the world trying to persuade their sons, daughters to stay at school, to pay a little bit more attention, you know, to find the holes in their pockets, let their pocket money run out far too fast. It was just, I mean, I was crying with laughter. And then the young boy trying to, you know, persuade his sister to stick up for him because he knew he was in trouble again. God, I laugh so much.
I love the line from him with which you start the fourth chapter of the book, which is titled Lessons and Life, in which you quote him as saying, "I am already ready to learn, although I do not always like being taught." So that speaks to the reality of someone who maybe was a more natural learner, just out and about living an active life and learning in that respect. And of course, that's ultimately very much what occurred. Explain a little more about, you think, the consequences of his rather sickly nature. I mean, in what way does that impact who he was and, in a sense, the life choices he made, where he ended up living? In what way was that significant in terms of charting his life's course?
I think his father, again, was a very wise man not to continually push him back to school, but to believe that he would learn through experience and through the pageantry of exploring other countries. And that also, in some ways, helped his health. But, of course, he didn't want to be constricted by the fact that he often wasn't very well. And, you know, they didn't have Anjan Extra, ibuprofen, or whatever we take now for headaches, or antibiotics or antiseptics in the same way that we do today. So he did, well, he wasn't very careful because he wanted to live a very active life. But he then decided he found the dry air of Egypt much more acceptable than the warm dankness of a British winter. And I have to say, I think today at Highclere, I would entirely agree with him. And it's the sort of those bottom times of the year in January, February, and March when there is a dampness to the air, which it's delightful to escape it for a bit. And of course, in those days, they couldn't just get on a plane and 4 hours be somewhere else. It was a whole adventure just in terms of traveling. And I think sometimes all of us today forget that. So going out to Egypt was a 2-week journey, but perhaps we miss that. Perhaps we're missing these elements of our life, and instead of which just enjoying an airport and traveling through the duty-free. But I just found those contrasts quite interesting. And of course, he really embraced the modern Egypt as well as the ancient Egypt. And he found in Egypt, he had something to do. He found, like all of us at some point find in life, what he wanted to do. I think I have found that I really enjoy writing and storytelling, and he found he really liked the past, the ancient Egypt, the excavation, the touching, the finding the works of art, the interpreting them. And of course, he did become incredibly well read, and his sister would say, you know, that there were few men as well read as he was. In the end, he became a complete bookworm. But because of who he was and his wealth and his money, he could also invite all the best experts of the day to have supper. And then you can learn so much from them. So he was always learning in that way. And he thoroughly enjoyed listening and absorbing all the information he could from all the best Egyptologists of the day. So he didn't think he knew it all. It was quite the opposite. Mm. And he did learn, but in a different way. And I think I am of them, but I am not an expert. And I can see in the same way as I've developed my own knowledge, that I think you can see how he developed his knowledge, mm. which was far deeper than mine. Mm.
You tell us a great deal about the whole family, and I think that's one of the things that makes the book especially interesting. And we certainly get to know his father. And and we get a sense that, well, in fact, you say it at one point, it was an almost impossible act to follow. That is, his father was so impressive. What significance do you think that played in terms of then what the fifth Earl of Carnarvon, what he chose to do and the adventures that he undertook? Was this to a large measure because he had a father who loomed so large and was trying really to stake his own claim to significance?
I don't think he was, actually. I think from his father he took that he should always try his best and do his best, but it wasn't going to be in the realms of academia. So when he was breeding his racehorses, he spent a huge amount of time trying to get every edge that he could in order to win the race. Or when he was driving the cars, he wanted to understand the engineering. He was very interested in early technology. But at the same time, as I was reading and understanding what he was doing, still, the newspapers almost every day would pop up with some reference to his father and what his father had achieved in Canada or what his father had said about the church. So his father's spirit did travel with him. And then I think when he found his own métier, his own profession that he enjoyed doing, he found something which he understood and knew that his father would also have much enjoyed. His father was president of the Antiquities Society here, very interested in archaeology, and obviously I found that each of them dug up some bronze tubuli here in Highclere. So it's clearly a Carnarvon passion and profession. It's investigating the past. You know, and obviously the fifth Earl then also investigated the Iron Age forts. So that's very much in the spirit of his father. And I think over time, and as his marriage settled down and developed, he also thoroughly enjoyed what his father-in-law, Alfred de Rothschild, gave him in terms of collecting and the beautiful things in life, which is another aspect of what has been collected by all those who've lived in this castle, where there's, you know, the veriest finest Pietra Dura table from Italy, or the very finest leather wall hangings from Cordoba, or the very finest Van Dyck, or the very finest, and so on. It's just these individual beautiful items defining a time or a part of the world. And I think it sort of unfolded during his life. And he became more confident in his own sense of humour. Mm. His sister was important, Winifred. She was always there in the background. But and I liked the fact he was brought up in quite a female household, which in a male estate I also found quite interesting. Right. Lots of women around him the whole time.
And certainly we get a sense that Winifred was a great source of support for him and encouragement, and it points even a champion on his behalf. I so appreciate that your book gives us kind of an intriguing perspective on this monumental discovery of the tomb of King Tutankhamun. And of course, we are celebrating the centennial of that extraordinary discovery. Just sum up for the sake of our listeners who maybe have not thought about this dramatic discovery in quite some time, just how unprecedented it was. I mean, compared to discoveries that had been made before it, what made this particular discovery so astounding?
It is still the only untouched tomb of an ancient Egyptian pharaoh ever found, more or less intact. I mean, it was just stupendous. Lord Carnarvon was a very unconventional man. He was the one who held the concession, And he was the one who used his money to pursue his passion. Without him, I'm not sure the tomb would ever yet have been found. I'm not sure anyone else would have looked for it. So he was absolutely essential to the discovery of the tomb. And when he found it, that was an interesting part of my book to write, because obviously, like any of us, I mean, he was entirely lost for words. And it was the silence that came across from his diaries and his notes, the silence of minutes as they tried to take him, to look. So almost to listen to what they were seeing in front of them, which was beyond anything anyone could ever have dreamt of.
Right.
And he was just the mind of Pharaoh. So it was extraordinary. And this man at that point trod onto the world stage, and he and his name was the front of every newspaper, I'm sure in Wisconsin, as well as in New York, as well as in Johannesburg, or England, or Japan. We had all been through the First World War, through a flu pandemic, and there was inflation. There were huge economic challenges. There were huge societal challenges. And then there was this glimpse back of a world 3,000 years old. That was something unbelievable. So it did catch the world's imagination, and it's extraordinary how we're facing so many of those challenges again today. But I think the more we look and learn, perhaps the better we can face such challenges today.
Absolutely. Your book, of course, gives us in rich detail that adventure, and it was years in the making, of course. He was in Egypt for years and working for years in that Valley of the Kings before stumbling upon this extraordinary tomb. And, of course, your book is also about his death not long thereafter, and, of course, the mystery that surrounded that. But we will leave it to our listeners to explore all of this and more in your remarkable book, which, again, is titled The Earl and the Pharaoh, From the Real Downton Abbey to the Discovery of Tutankhamun. And I should say that the book includes remarkable photographs as well that take us into the rich and eventful life of the fifth Earl of Carnarvon. And the author of this book, the Countess of Carnarvon, the current occupant of Highclere Castle, I thank you so much, Countess, for joining me today on The Morning Show, and congratulations on a wonderfully written book.
You are so good. I loved writing it. I hope people will love reading it. He was an extraordinary man, and his legacy has made us all so much richer.
I very much agree.
You are listening to The Morning Show on WGTD HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg, and now an interview that comes from The Morning Show archive. We spend this portion of WGTD's Morning Show talking about a very interesting memoir. In fact, the subtitle of this memoir says, A Memoir of Going to Extremes. And boy, that is a really apt way to describe the story of Francis Slakey, and the story told in his memoir, To the Last Breath. Professor Francis Slakey decided, for sort of an interesting mix of reasons, to undertake a very rare, maybe unprecedented gauntlet, to climb the highest mountain on every continent on Earth and to surf every ocean on Earth. And along the way, in ways that he could not possibly have anticipated, Francis Slakey ended up sort of discovering a lot about himself and in a sense opening himself up to new experiences, especially on sort of an emotional level that he had never anticipated before. Growing from a state which he at one point in the book describes as cold and broken. It's really an amazing story, and a story full of surprises and also some really death-defying drama as well. And I'm very excited that I can speak with Francis Slakey, or should I say Professor Francis Slakey, Upjohn Lecturer on Physics and Public Policy at Georgetown University. And he writes a great deal on the relationship between science and society at large, co-founder of the program on Science in the Public Interest. And maybe you have heard him on NPR or seen his work in National Geographic, Washington Post, The New York Times, and other places. This book, again, is titled To the Last Breath, A Memoir of Going to Extremes, published by Simon & Schuster. Francis Slakey, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Thank you, Greg. Pleasure to be on.
This is quite an interesting story, and I would also say that it's a very, in a sense, sort of asymmetrical story, or maybe I don't want to sound uncomplimentary, but it's kind of an untidy story compared to some books. I mean, in the
sense... it makes me wonder how many people's lives are actually tidy to begin with. I think when you set out to write a memoir, either you try to clean it up and gloss it up and make it pretty, or you just tell things as they happen. And in my case, I just told it all.
Absolutely.
I told it all as it happened. Yeah.
It's one of the things that makes this book so really very, very interesting, and unexpectedly so, in the sense that we might glance at the cover and glance at the title and figure that this is going to be another book about climbing a lot of mountains. And there are a lot of books out there like that. But in many respects, what ends up being far more dramatic for you than climbing Mount Everest is the experience of sort of self-discovery and self-transformation that occurs.
Oh, absolutely. You know, and it began, some of that transformation began at Everest. The whole journey took 12 years, and there were moments in the journey where just completely unexpected things happen. You know, I tell you, Greg, when you set out into the world, you discover there are things that happen out there that are way beyond your control. And when I began the journey, I think I just thought I could control all my circumstances, and discovered pretty quickly into it that that things were just way beyond what I could control myself. And those things eventually just influenced me to the point where I became a different person.
Before we actually talk about your story, I wonder if you could just say a word about what you understood at the time versus what became clearer as you sat down and wrote this book. I think I talked to a lot of authors in which the act of sitting down and putting a story down on paper provides all kinds of clarification. I wonder if that was really the case with you. It sounds in many ways like much of the clarification really did happen through the course of this journey. And then
it's an interesting combination, Greg. So it did happen through the course of the journey. And just to make it clear to your listeners just how much change there was in my life, you know, 15 years ago I had what I called my pillars. I mean, they were the foundations of my life. And it was, I would never get married. I would never have kids. I would never buy a house, because any one of those things would create attachments, and I just didn't want any attachments. And here I am more than a decade later, married. I have twin girls in a home that I own. So all of those pillars just tumbled away, and they tumbled away one after another over the course of the journey when I realized that I had just been thinking way too narrowly about myself and about the world.
In describing yourself before this transformation took place, you at one point evoke the words cold and broken.
I do. You know, it's something that people attributed to me, and I don't think I fully grasped it at the time, but I had started out my journey by going to Africa and climbing Kilimanjaro. It was a routine climb. Nothing unexpected happened on the climb itself. It was, as I found so many times during the journey, it was the circumstances that surrounded the event, the climb or the surfing, that influenced me. And in the case of Kilimanjaro, it was when I confronted some Maasais in the savanna that surrounds Kilimanjaro, and I met with one of the elders of the tribe, and we had, you know, an exchange, and I sort of stepped into things. I ended up writing a story about it. When that story was published, readers reacted sharply to it and suggested that I was cold and broken, and that, I think, I hadn't really confronted that until I read the readers' responses at that point.
Hmm. And, of course, this whole journey around the world and all these adventures end up being kind of a gauntlet of self-examination and coming to better understand this truth, uncomfortable truth about yourself. Let's turn back earlier, though, into the story for a moment, because one of the most interesting moments in the story, in the book, is when you take us back to when you were 11 years old and your mother died from cancer.
Yeah.
And describe this moment to our listeners and describe what you believe to be its sort of lasting consequences.
Yeah, and I think this is one of those moments, Greg, you had asked a few minutes ago, were there things that came to me in the act of writing the book? And I think this is one thing I really came to grips with when I wrote the book. And this was when my mother died when I was young. But shortly before she died, we were passing each other in the hallway. She had declined, her health had declined to the point where she could no longer walk. And my father was carrying her down the hallway. And there she was in his arms, and it was a narrow hallway, and my father had to turn, and so we passed each other. My mother and I barely touched each other. She didn't say any words, but I felt something at the time. I mean, I heard her voice. I still hear it today. And she said, "Be strong." And I think at the time, I misunderstood what she was trying to convey with that, and thought that I interpreted it more as defiance and, you know, get out there in the world and conquer it and take it on. And it was only much later in my life, in fact, at the end of my journey, when I realized that those words had a much different intention.
Hmm. I think that really makes a lot of sense. That I think a lot of people can act in that way and believe it on some level to be exactly the right thing to do, to put up sort of a stoic front, to try to kind of thicken one's skin, if that's possible, and sort of weather the blow rather than really feeling it deeply. And do you feel like that sort of marked you for a long time afterwards? I mean, is that what sort of set you on this path for such a long time of in a sense living coldly and disconnected from others?
Yes, I think so. I think that certainly contributed to it. Shortly after that, I was in Utah, and a friend and I were climbing, and he decided he wanted to try to climb down a mountain. I was uneasy about it. I told him I would meet him at the bottom. I would take a bus ride down the mountain, and he could climb down on his own. And he fell in his attempt to down climb and died from that. And, you know, so it was, I think those two things back to back, Greg, really just iced me up and made me the detached person I was for so many years.
I really think you put it well in describing, going back to actually to your mother's deterioration and eventually her death from cancer. You said that I reacted by thickening my defenses. I decided that I would never again let something cut into me so deeply. And of course, little could you have imagined that the journey out of that state of being would involve mountain climbing and surfing and so on. I mean, I think the unlikelihood of that and the fact that all of this surprised you is probably a big reason why it happened. I mean, why it ended up being, in a sense, the most effective sort of cure for that kind of
ill. Yeah, well said. I mean, I think when it helped me step out, and it made me realize, particularly when I had a confrontation in the jungles of Indonesia, I would say that was one of the real turning points in my life. And let me just say a few words about it for your listeners. But there's a mountain in Irian Jaya that's surrounded by jungle. And rather than trying to hack through all the jungle, my climbing partner and I decided that we would cut through a mine that butts up right next to the mountain. And in order to do that, we decided we would bribe the Indonesian military that guards the mine. I have to make that confession to your readers that that I did commit that felony offense of bribing a military officer. But in any case, that officer took the money, drove us up the mine. We did our climb. We drove back down. And as we were coming back down the mine, soldiers stepped out in front of the Jeep. They started yelling at us, and our driver started yelling back. I didn't understand what was being said. I yelled at the driver, what's going on? And then suddenly this voice cut through everything, and I did understand it because it was in English. And the soldier said, get out of the Jeep. And we got out of the Jeep. We were surrounded by the soldiers. I figured we only had a few moments to come up with some solution, and we just opened up our wallets. We just gave them more money, and they backed away, and we drove on. But then a few days later, I discovered in an when I picked up an international newspaper that someone else was in a Jeep driving down the very same road, was surrounded by soldiers at that very same spot. But in their case, the soldiers pulled the triggers. And two people were gunned down dead, seven more critically injured. And just a few months later, I would be sitting across the table from one of the women, Patsy Spear, who survived that ambush. She had been rushed to a hospital. She had 100 pieces of shrapnel in her internal organs. Her internal organs actually had to be taken out, put into a tray in front of her, and tweezed to take out the shrapnel. And she survived that. And when I sat across the table from her and talked through that ambush and realized I was talking to somebody who had taken the bullet instead of me. I had dodged a bullet and met the person who took that bullet instead of me, and I tell you, Greg, that just changed my life. Mm. It really brought me out of my shell. Mm.
In the experience that you actually had, I mean, of that of being in such dire danger in that jungle in Indonesia. One of the things you describe that is just sort of searing in its intensity is you say this situation was totally outside my control. There was no rope that I could decide to pull or not pull. Instead, there were only triggers, and it was up to the soldiers, not me, to decide whether to pull them or not. This was not the kind of dramatic moment that I seek. This was utter helplessness. I mean, I think all of us can well understand how frightening a situation like this would be. But in a sense, for you, it was even more than frightening. It was also for you probably the most vulnerable and powerless you had ever felt in your whole life.
Yeah, that's true. And I at so many stages in my life, decisions that I've made, I felt like I had control of the circumstances, and it was up to me to determine what path I would follow. And when I confronted that situation, it was truly just, and it was outside of my control, and there was this helpless feeling that I had. And then, you know, compounding that just days later to find out that someone else was in the same situation and had the disastrous outcome of bullets being shot at him. And I to the combination of me experiencing the helplessness and then discovering, actually meeting the person who had to survive that ambush, it's a very powerful experience. Hmm.
We're speaking with Francis Slakey about his book, To the Last Breath, A Memoir of Going to Extremes. That's really probably the most dramatic, but by no means not the only moment in which your life was in danger and you were taxed beyond your sort of immediate abilities and resources. I mean, really brushing up against danger, that happened again and again. You say early in the book, the journey, this ultimate journey that you take all around the world, would completely unravel me and then bind me back together into someone who could feel and care. I wonder if you could say a word about the process of being unraveled. And if we are talking about, for instance, that those experiences of complete vulnerability that you just described happening in the jungles of Indonesia at gunpoint, or if we are talking about other factors beyond that, and maybe some fairly subtle that that also contributed to this process of unraveling?
Certainly it was Indonesia and the helplessness I felt at that moment. There were other moments along the way. Let me describe one to your listeners. It was on Everest, and I think what I summited it solo, so I was alone. It was there was a blizzard. It was just whiteout conditions, and then in my descent, I discovered a couple other climbers who had gotten into just horrible circumstances. And what I witnessed was just the heroism and the selflessness of my climbing partner, Jim Williams, and his, you know, lucid decisions and his willingness to put his own life at risk to save another. And that seeing the heroism of someone, just being in that circumstance, confronted with the same decisions that that he is confronted with, but seeing him make the decision that would put his own life in jeopardy to save another, it's like holding a mirror up to yourself, and you discover who you are, and you discover just how pure an act can be, and that's what I saw, and that certainly contributed to my own change.
You so powerfully and vividly describe the experience of being in Antarctica, which at one point you describe as one massive sensory deprivation tank. So much that is around you is like nothing we ever see or hear or
right.
Feel.
There's nothing for your senses to sort of seize onto, and you go through your typical day, and there's so many things that from the moment you wake up, your alarm clock, bang, you hear something. You walk down the hall, and maybe your coffee's already brewing, and you smell that. And then you open the morning paper, and the visuals, get you. You turn on your radio, and you hear Greg on the radio. You're constantly confronted with sounds and sights, colors, and but in Antarctica, there's nothing. There's nothing for your senses to grab hold of. It's lifeless, so there's no sound of an animal, of a lawnmower. it's odorless. And you're encased in a down suit because it's so cold. 40, 50 below zero that you can't have any exposed skin. So you have nothing to touch. So there was nothing for the senses to grab a hold of, and the only thing you see is just the white of the ice and the white of the sky, and at the time that we were climbing, the sun just sort of sat a little bit low in the horizon, never set, and so it's constantly illuminated, and there's no change in the landscape really. So it felt like it just a big sensory deprivation tank.
Mm. Coupled with your own experiences in Antarctica, you do such a beautiful job of describing the plight of Robert Falcon Scott and his ill-fated party who attempted to be the first to reach the South Pole, falling short. Roald Amundsen, the Norwegian, gets there first, and Captain Robert Falcon Scott and all of his men perish in their journey back. And you describe not only crucial errors, heartbreaking errors which he made, but also very movingly describe the sense of connectedness which Captain Scott seemed to feel in the last hours and minutes of his life.
That's, to me, the most compelling part of the story, Greg. So plenty of scholars have looked at Scott's expedition and determined whether he was a sound leader, just experiencing circumstances beyond his control, or whether he was an inept leader. And that's not a debate I wanted to get into, because what I found in the end, what I found so compelling is literally his final moments as he realizes he's not going to make it back. He's going to freeze to death in Antarctica, and he'll never return to England again. He will never see his family again. And it was at that moment he picked up a pen and wrote. And so you get the final words of someone who has confronted his own isolation, in the most desperate of circumstances. And what does he do? He expresses his love for his family. And when I thought about that and realized, look, I don't want to die alone and detached. And so when I was confronting my own isolation in Antarctica, I thought back to that final moment Scott had and realized I don't want to suffer that end. And that also contributed to my reconnection with the world.
If we have time for one more story, I find it interesting that on the heels of that discussion about Antarctica, you turn your attention to your own father, an English professor, mm-hmm. and many of the ways in which he raised you and your brothers, and how, in particular, he was a child of the Great Depression. Mm-hmm. And that guided many of the values he had and priorities as a father. I mean, I really love this part of the book, particularly the story of the glass mustard jar, I mean, and living life in that respect. Can you just say a word about the juxtaposition of these two stories in your book?
So my father, and he had such a challenging time. You know, there are three of us. I was the youngest. I had two older brothers. My mother dies, and he's got to somehow keep all this together. And, yeah, I think he went back to what formed him, which was the Great Depression. And I remember moments when we were growing up where he would hold that mustard jar up to the light. He would take his spatula and make sure he got just that last bit of mustard, like it was buffed clean by the time that he was done with it. And that sort of stolid approach that he had, I think, is the steadiness that he had, is what got all of us through our childhood. And I did reflect on that when I was in Antarctica and realized, you know, that there were moments when we just challenged him to the breaking point. But he was steadfast, and he remained solid. And despite the challenges that I had in my own life and the burdens that I put on him, you know, he stood beside me, stood strong.
Hmm. Well, it's an amazing story. It truly is, that takes us all around the globe and into very, very surprising moments. And of course, no one is more surprised than you at where this journey ultimately takes you, ultimately into marriage, ultimately into Buddhism, ultimately into a life and a view of the world that you never would have thought could be yours. And our listeners can see it all in your book, To the Last Breath, A Memoir of Going to Extremes, published by Simon & Schuster, including some very interesting photographs, I might add. The author, Francis Slakey. Francis Slakey, thank you so much for telling this powerful and compelling story so well and for joining me on The Morning Show today to talk about it.
Thank you, Greg.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, our studios will be closed because of the approaching holidays, but we will still have a Morning Show podcast, and tomorrow it's from the archives, my interview with Hector McDonald, author of Truth, How the Many Sides to Every Story Shape Our Reality. Really thought-provoking book that I hope that you will take the time to listen to. Some holiday-related fare will be offered up in the Morning Show podcast over the weekend. On Saturday, Christmas Eve Day, memorable conversation with the editor of the 40th anniversary edition of Dr. Seuss's How the Grinch Stole Christmas, one of the great classics, of course, of our time. Next week, the podcast of The Morning Show will feature 2022 interviews, all related to important events and occasions like the Kemper 150th anniversary, Gateway Technical College.